then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's September the 18th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, the first thing I'd like to do this week is briefly update something I said last week when I asked for clarification on whether Cindy Steele ever saw her husband again after he was dragged away from the courtroom in May of 2011 by the U.S. Marshals. Apparently not. She repeatedly tried to get the right to be allowed to visit her husband in Victorville, and I'm told she even tried to get congressional intervention to allow her to visit, but she was simply ignored, and so was the congressman. Down through the years, there have been repeated back-channel rumors about the kind of pressure that has been put on Cindy Steele by the FBI and other servants of the dictatorship to shut up and play along with the script. And if those rumors are true, then Cindy is just as much a victim of these monsters as Ed. But since these are not confirmed, and I don't have permission to discuss what's been going on, I won't get into it here. Now, what I did learn was that in May of this year, after 2.5 years, Ed's son and daughter were allowed 2 6-hour visits under very closely supervised conditions to make sure that Ed didn't smuggle any written words or communications out of the prison. I don't know why they would do that if not to cover their own asses, because they knew at that point that Ed's days were numbered, and they knew what it would look like if the Bureau of Prisons cut off all communication between the prisoner and his family for almost 3 years. And by the way, Ed's mail is now coming back to me marked RTF. It never came back before, so I can't help but wonder what happened to all that mail that I was sending him and which he never received. Now, I'll be playing bits and pieces of Ed's podcasts, as I have in the past on this show, mostly downloaded from his Conspiracy Pen Pal site, but I'd like to ask that any of you out there who have any other recordings of speeches or interviews or whatever by either Edgar Steele or Cindy Steele, please get them to me through sendspace.com or however you can. Make sure they're in MP3 format. If you are taking this off of video, if you can, please strip the soundtrack off first. I have a guy that can do it for me, but it's just kind of complex, and I'd appreciate it if you could save me some work there. Now, in other news from the prison industrial complex, I'm sure that by now most of you have heard that Bill White was convicted in Florida on September the 12th of engaging in a quote-unquote electronic reign of terror, whatever the hell that means, and also of the apparently quite serious crime of being in two places at once, specifically Florida and Mexico, since the courts have now proven that he was sending naughty emails and making politically incorrect comments to Facebook from both places at approximately the same time. Yes, it really has gotten that deranged and completely corrupt in our little slice of heaven here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. That's almost as good as the Jacksonville police swallowing the story that J.W. Waters accidentally shot and killed himself while playing Russian roulette with an automatic. And no, I'm not making that up. Look, when the government of the United States wants someone dead, they die. And now here's the Northwest Nationalist, Northwest England, that is. Once again, I encourage Europeans whose English is good enough to make MP3s describing what's going on in their country and saying the things that they can't say at home, and send them to me for broadcast on this program. Yes, I know it's dangerous. I know that your local hate crime police or whatever may track you down and arrest you for hate speech or whatever. But if you're willing to take the risk, I will make sure that your voice is heard by our own little wee audience at the moment, and also enshrined in the immortality of the internet for all time.
Greetings, comrades. This is the Northwest Nationalist. I'll primarily be using this to respond to Radio Free Northwest Edition 239, which was August 21st, to reinforce what Harold said with regards to the immigration issue and the frustration caused by the fact that so many of you Americans, with the opportunities abundant to move to the Northwest at any time with very little difficulty, perhaps even no difficulty at all, at least in the practical moving there and getting there securely, what is it going to take for you to realize just how much of a virtue you have? Because from my position, getting to the Northwest is going to be a nightmare, whereas for you, it can be extremely easy. So if there are any of you sitting there now who are very sympathetic to the Northwest Front and would migrate, I can't stress enough how important it is to migrate now, to get moving now rather than later, because you have the opportunity. And for those of us who don't, it is extremely, extremely annoying to see when Americans refuse to move for varying reasons. For those that could quite easily move to the Northwest but don't, because, well, you've all heard in previous editions of Radio Free Northwest the varying reasons for refusals to migrate. It's pointless to get into that anymore. For us European nationals, and especially for those of us in the United Kingdom, America doesn't want us. For a long time it hasn't, and getting there now is very, very difficult. So when you're debating your migration, just think about how immensely lucky you are. What is it going to take to get you to move? I'm making some kind of an example here. For those of you that have seen the show Breaking Bad, the gentleman in that series receives a life-threatening situation wherein he is very much forced to become aware of his situation, where he is no longer in control, and he has to go to great lengths to take some element of control to secure his family. What I'm trying to say is here, what is it going to take for you to wake up? What is it going to take for you to realize what is happening around you? And what is it going to take for you to up sticks and migrate? Do you really want to sit idly by while the situation grows worse day by day by day? Are you just going to sit and listen to these Radio Free Northwest and think, huh, brilliant if I could migrate, but for varying reasons, I'm not going to migrate? Look, it comes down to a simple fact that migration now is better than migrating when the situation is completely untenable. When we are forced to break bad, and when the NVA becomes very much a reality, Portland and other areas would naturally become a hotbed for organizations like those depicted in the Northwest novels. FATPO and, you know, FBI, Terrorist Response Agency, you get the idea. And how do you plan to move into that kind of situation when the USA starts to fall apart, when the Western world gradually collapses under the strain of, well, you've heard it all before, so let's not go into the reasons why. We'll just go into why you need to migrate now. Stop thinking, start doing. Because I know for a fact that I will try everything possible once I finish my studies to get to the Northwest, bringing as many assets, bringing as much knowledge, and bringing as much experience in practical terms as I can with me. I sure as hell don't intend to stay in England, which is already a very much lost bastion of the old English race. But you Americans have the opportunity to move now. You don't have these restrictions, the petty refusal for white immigrants. What I'm trying to say is, and this is a plea almost, you must understand that it is a massive, massive, great thing that you have. You are able to move at any time. You are able to up sticks and go now. And Harold has told you so many times what you need to do, and yet you're still refusing to do it. And then you wonder why the NF isn't in the papers or on the very strong presence on the internet. And you wonder why there's no boots on the ground, or at least ones that you think you can't see. And deep down, you know the reasons why. And in all honesty, it is entirely your own fault. And I'm not a member of the Northwest Front because I'm not in the Northwest. I simply, in the time between my leaving England and getting to the Northwest, intend to do as much as possible to convince you people what you need to do and what you've been told to do for a very long time. And for those of you who are able, and for those of you who will, actual monetary assets are also incredibly important. If there are any of you out there who are willing to donate, then you should immediately, or at least purchase the Northwest Independence novels and purchase the White Book online. There are many ways in which you can help the Northwest Front, but the primary way of helping is by migrating. Think very, very carefully and think for a long time on what your options are, and consider just how much the white race means to you, how much survival means to you. Because for me, and for many others, it means everything. And for our race to perish is not an option. For the history of the Third Reich to be completely forgotten is not an option. And if you realize this, and if you understand this, and if you support this, then migrate. Or to the Northwest, sorry. March ever onwards, comrades.
And by the way, for those of you who are interested in historical trivia from the Second World War, the musical number that the Northwest Nationalist used to open his contribution there was the opening to Les Préludes by Franz Liszt, and historically it was always the introductory musical lead-in on the radio during the Third Reich period when the National Socialist State was about to announce a major military victory on the Eastern Front.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to be reviewing The New Right versus The Old Right, and this is a series of essays that really go after some very pertinent issues. Now, these essays are primarily talking about metapolitics and hegemony. Now, metapolitics is about education and community organizing. And hegemony is about having a situation where every choice is going to be a good or at least acceptable choice. This author spends some time talking about the left and how the left is always moving on to new goals, and it's always stepping over its own history, and it never gets involved in historical distractions. And he gives the example of being caught distributing leaflets and how it would be much better to talk about changing demographics than it would be to go into some revisionist diatribe that very few people would understand. He says that opinion is really everything in politics. And that's why dictatorships will spend so much time on propaganda, because it's necessary to take the moral high ground. And really, a need for a white homeland could be a moral high ground. He says that really what white nationalists have is the truth and the high ground. And why would we ever abandon this? Because it's really our strong suit. Yes, he talks about people who try to be mainstream because of attachment to society as it is. And he talks about his own difficulties in that he always wanted an academic career in philosophy. And in fact, in these essays, he talks about the good life and the different modes of life. modes of life that deal with either spirit or desire or reason, and how those who are ruled by spirit or by reason tend to be the revolutionary, because they are the ones that will seek the good of the soul over other goods in life. And he talks about how he found it difficult to get really involved in the movement and be explicit in the movement until he finally decided that he had to give up his attachment to the bourgeois comforts. The author realizes that there are some people who will be undercover, but the author really favors explicit white nationalism and says that those who are purists are 95% correct, but that these purists should be reminded that historical forces are not just disembodied, but that individuals can affect history even though most individuals do not. Now, white nationalists really need to aspire to being a mass movement, and they need educated people, younger people, especially college students, and those from higher incomes. Now, granted, these people tend to have more to lose, and thus traditionally have been less involved with the movement, but they also have more to give in terms of money and knowledge. Now, he tackles certain difficult issues, and one of those is the issue of religion, and he says that there are people that don't like Christianity, and that these people have a point, but the church is really interested in the hereafter, and the church will really bend to any regime in ours. But that it's important to be consistent, and we need to always back ethno-nationalism. We have to make sure that we always love more than we hate. Because, again, the moral high ground is where people want to be. Now, the author reminds us that freedom is the opportunity to make a momentous choice, and that in a white society that had hegemony, whites could still argue over many things. Only the 14 words would be universally agreed upon. And he reminds us that right now, at least, we tend to be a very individualistic group. And so, when we think of our own activism, the model is more a Montessori school than an H.J. rally. And he says this is something that we should realize and understand that it's just our nature at this point and that we should just roll with that. Now, the author maintains that it's really too early for either revolution or it's also impossible to vote our way out of the situation. So the author seems to believe that this is a time for education and community organizing, and that fortunately there are a lot of younger people that are waking up to the situation because they're seeing what the society is becoming and there's more wakefulness at this point. So there's a certain optimism on the part of the author, although the author is not a Pollyanna, and there are certainly criticisms of this society. In fact, the author laments that this is a society of extroverts who are desperate for approval. And the author talks about apostasy and why some people would want to abandon the truth. The author, being a philosopher, has a difficult time understanding why anyone would abandon the truth, but says that everyone must decide their own level of commitment. One of the authors that is mentioned in these essays is Douglas Hyde. Douglas Hyde was a communist author that wrote a book called Dedication and Leadership. And this book goes into the way that radical communists were forged by the party. And as I was preparing my notes for this episode, I was recalling the fact that back in the early days of National Socialism, communists who wanted to become National Socialists were accepted into the party much more quickly than those who were moderates. And that's because the radical communists had experience with radicalism, and they were ready and willing to make total life commitment. So the next time that I come on the show, or maybe the time after that, depending on when the book arrives, I'm going to be discussing Douglas Hyde's book. It is spoken of somewhat in these essays, but I would like to read the actual book because it sounds very exciting. Now, the other thing the author talks about in these essays, because again, he deals with difficult subjects, is he talks about the issue of people coming into the movement who are mentally unwell, and he talks about learning the signs of someone who may be unstable and avoiding these people, because really, at the end of the day, it's better to do nothing than to cause harm. So it's better to have one less person as a possible recruit into the movement than bring the wrong people into the movement. So these are very honest essays, and because they touch on so many important subjects and they really don't shy away from a self-critical nature, I would really highly recommend this book. So thank you for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
In the year 1845, the noted British seaman and explorer Sir John Franklin set sail from England with 128 men in two well-equipped vessels, the HMS Erebus and the Terror, in order to attempt to navigate the Northwest Passage around the north of Canada and find a sea route into the Pacific Ocean. This was in the days before the Panama Canal and also before steam engines were fully utilized on ships, and the only way to get to Asia at that time was a long voyage lasting almost a year around South Africa, or even worse, the tip of South America, and so there was still a great deal of commercial interest in finding some shorter and faster route. To make a long story short, Franklin, both of his ships and all of his men, disappeared. We know that they were icebound and that eventually the expedition abandoned their vessels and tried to walk southward to one of the Hudson Bay trading posts in northern Canada, but they all died along the way from exhaustion or else from bad meat in the early canned provisions they carried, in a time when canning procedures weren't quite as efficient as they are today. A number of the graves of these men have been found down through the years under cairns of stones along the way. And it's really eerie to look at the modern photographs of the dead bodies, because they were completely frozen and they look almost alive. It's hard to remember that you're looking at the face of a white man who was born in the time of Napoleon and who knew a world where our people ruled the earth. A large part of that mystery involves what happened to his ships, which were abandoned on the ice in late 1846. For many years, Eskimos and sailors reported seeing the masts and the hulks of the Erebus and Terror far away across the pack ice, and in one case actually elevated several hundred feet above the sea on an iceberg, but these reports were never confirmed. On September the 4th, Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper announced that one of the ships from the Franklin expedition has been found underwater, and that plans are afoot to go down and explore the wreck, although they may have to wait until a brief Arctic summer next year when the weather clears up a bit. The story of the Franklin expedition has always been one of the most enduring legends of the sea and of white exploration. The grave of Sir John Franklin himself has never been found. This is Pentangle.
Was homeward bound one night on the dune, swinging in my hammock I fell asleep. I dreamed a dream and I thought it true, concerning Franklin and his gallant crew. With 100 seamen he sailed to the frozen ocean in the month of May, to seek a passage around the pole. But we poor seamen do sometimes go. Through cruel hardships their nameless draw, their ships on mountains of ice was drawn. Only the Eskimo in his skin canoe is the only one that ever came through. Baffin Bay, where the whale fishes blow, the fate of Franklin no man may know. The fate of Franklin no tongue can tell. Lord Franklin alone with his sailors do well. Now my bird love Franklin, I would cross the main. 10,000 pounds would I free give to say on earth that my Franklin.
Well, good afternoon. Welcome back. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio. Today is Thursday, July 24th, 2014. My guest today is Harold Covington. Harold, welcome back, sir.
Okay.
Anyway, we've got about 30 minutes left. What do you want to talk about? What's on your mind? What important things do you want the listeners to know and understand out there?
Well, I believe that the people of this country, by which I mean the white people, of course, have to understand what is happening to them. And I think they do. I think at the root of every white man or woman's soul, personality, whatever, they do understand that something is very, very badly wrong, and they are actually looking for answers. It's been a long time, but I genuinely am starting to get the impression that there is something akin to a mass awakening in the white blob, so to speak. Even if it's only a vague disquiet, a knowledge that something is wrong, they need to understand that there is a solution and they need to be brought to our website. But let me just get into exactly what I envision as the Northwest solution. The first step, and what we're pushing right now, is to build communities where white nationalists, white separatists, normal people, however you want to define white people, who have been
let me interject something on that comment, because it's just people who want to live around people of their own kind, their own color, and who don't like the idea that integration was forced on this country. And it's about time that people realize that maybe integration was not the right thing to do. Maybe it was a mistake. And maybe it's time for Black America and white America to talk about getting a divorce.
Yeah, in our movement, such as it is, and it's not very large, I admit that, but in our movement, we have every tendency of white people you can imagine. We have everything from, you know, outright national socialists to pagans and people who are into the whole ecology and nature thing to Christians of various sorts, Christian identity, Second Amendment people, sovereign citizen people, tax revolt, Federal Reserve, economically interested people. It just, we are a movement of blood, not of faith or creed. To us, the important thing is race. Unless you preserve the race, then nothing else of white civilization or Western civilization, nothing we've created is going to survive. Now, what we have to do is we have to form communities where people of like mind live and work and make their lives within half an hour's drive of one another. We have got to stop relying on these machines, these computers and whatnot, to bring about some solution because, okay, the internet revolution has been very important in many ways. I don't deny that. It has given us access to mass media and mass communications in a way we never had before. I do not deny that. But past a point, it is my genuine belief still, after many years of doing this and working with this, that the internet causes more problems than it solves, and I'm aware that most of your people are listening to me right now on the internet, so the irony does not escape me. We have developed, I think, in white America and in our attempts to build a resistance movement, a tendency to confuse internet with reality, to believe that when we sit down at a computer and we spend our night or our evening tapping away on a blog or in a chat room or making posts on certain bulletin boards, blah, 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 and we get up and at the end of it and say, wow, I got a lot done tonight. No, you didn't. What you did was you generated words. I once knew an old Hungarian freedom fighter, one of the kids that was throwing Molotov cocktails at the Soviet tanks in Budapest in 1956, and he told me, he says, Harold, you know, you people are going to lose because you are fighting the worst tyranny that the world has ever known with nothing but words. Tyranny does not respond to words, and this is what I spend most of my life trying to do. I try to get white people to respond to our message with something besides words. And somehow or other, we are going to have to get the millions and millions and millions of white people who still live in this country, who are still capable of helping, who still have the assets and the skills and the character to help if they can simply be shown the way. We are going to have to get them to respond with something besides words. Either generating words themselves or sitting there listening to words on a radio or a computer. Words are not going to solve this problem. Votes, clicking a little lever in a machine every 4 years, is not going to solve this problem. Whatever route we choose to try and save ourselves from genocide and save our country and our way of life from extinction is going to have to involve something which entails physical risk. Nothing that is worth having can be had without risking death and prison and mutilation. Nothing can be had that is worth having without effort, work, blood, sweat, and tears, as Winston Churchill put it. We white people in America have lost the capability of putting that type of effort into anything. We have to recover it. The first step is to come to the Pacific Northwest and move into a community and make your life there. People seem to think sometimes when I tell them to come home to the Northwest that they're going to rock up here and there's this big revolution going and they're going to be handed a rifle and go out and told to join the NVA and blow something up. No, that's not what's happening. What is important is for white people to come here to what will be their homeland, to the land that God and destiny has appointed for us to make our last stand and prove ourselves worthy of survival. Build a home, sink your roots, raise a family. Remember, the first English colonists arrived in this country, 1607 in Jamestown. And it wasn't until 1775, which was 168 years later, something like that, that they were ready and able to revolt against King George and break ties with England. Before they could do that, they had to come over here in their wooden boats. They had to settle the wilderness. They had to build their cabins. They had to plant their crops. They had to build their communities, build their churches, build their schools, raise generations of new kids that were Americans. That has to happen here in the Northwest. Again, not the best example in the world, but it took the Israelis 58 years of bringing Jews into the Holy Land until they got strong enough to take over. That process is beginning now. We are having to do right now here in the Northwest things that we should have been doing 50 years ago. And that's terrible. I hate to say that. I know people don't want to hear that. And I blame myself for it to some degree. But the fact is, we have to start from scratch. We have to build economic and social infrastructure. We have to have those communities of white racial people. We have to do in the Northwest what the Mexicans have been doing in this country for generations. We have to deliberately change the demographics. To some degree, that's already happening right now because of Pastor Butler and Aryan Nations, and also because of people like Mark Furman moving up to Sandpoint, Idaho. There is now an area in northern Idaho where it is virtually impossible for a Democratic political candidate to have any chance of succeeding. It's the reddest part of the reddest state in the country. So it can be done. Many of the people who are fleeing from California, white people who are fleeing from California, some are going to Nevada, some are going to Arizona, but a lot of them are coming up here. And so that is what I want to try and convey to your audience. There is a plan. Somebody is doing something about this, but you have to participate, and it's going to be hard. It's going to be inconvenient. You are going to have to quit your job where you are. You are going to have to find a job here in the Northwest. You are going to have to sell your house if you own it. You're going to have to do all the things that you would normally do for money if you were offered a, you know, $300,000 a year job here in the Northwest. But you're going to have to do it on your own because it is right. And that's where it gets hard.
Amen. And, you know, Harold, why don't you tell people about your books and where they can acquire them? There's two reasons to read the books. One of them is you articulate the plan that you just talked about there in a very concise, fictional manner. And two, they're fun to read. And you read them and you go, wow, that was cool. I can't believe he actually said that. And it allows white people to identify with what being white is supposed to be like. Not what it is in this cultural Marxism that we live, this political correct nonsense, but what it's supposed to be like. That it's action, it's adventure, it's a shoot 'em up, it's a romance story, it's intrigue, it's betrayal, it's everything in there. It's really, it's a kitchen sink. It's a series, what, five books now you've got?
And, it's the Northwest Quintet, yes. Now, I've actually written a total of 20 books now, but the five you're referring to are the Northwest Independence novels. These are a series of novels in what you might call a mythos. I didn't intend for it to be that way, but it just kind of took on a life of its own. And what I describe in there is a revolution which takes place in the Pacific Northwest based largely on the things that I observed when I was living in Ireland, watching the activities of the IRA and the various paramilitaries in the north there. And I describe the creation of the type of white homeland that the party, the Northwest Front, advocates creating in one, and this is one way in which it could be created. I'm not saying that my scenario in the Northwest novels is absolutely...
Well, it's fictional. Come on, it's just fictional.
Yeah, right, it is. But the thing is, one of the things I've always felt, again, in the movement is that we had this sense of drift and no one really knew where we were going, what we were going to do. It's kind of like putting together a jigsaw puzzle. In order for you to put together a jigsaw puzzle, you have to have the cover of the box and know what the picture looks like that you're trying to put together. And so in my five Northwest novels, I show white people the cover of the puzzle box. They know what they're aiming for, they've got their eyes on the prize, and this is one way in which it could be created. Now, in many ways, the most important, I think, of the books, the last one that I completed about a year ago, it's called Freedom's Sons. Now, what that does is it begins at the end, so to speak, after the Longview Treaty, when the United States has finally agreed to withdraw from the Northwest, and it takes the next 50 years of the Northwest Republic, and it follows that 50 years through basically through three families. One was a rebel family in VA, one was more or less Unionist, and the other was a family of white refugees who fled from Chicago to the Northwest with nothing but the clothes on their backs. And I think that's one of the most important chapters of any book I ever wrote, when I described what happened to the Horakova family in Chicago and how they literally had to leave one morning running for the Northwest for their lives because the authorities were after them because of a racial incident. That is how, I'm sorry to say, most people are probably going to end up coming to the Northwest. If you don't come now, while you can do so in an orderly manner, bringing your assets and bringing your families and your lives with you, there is every chance that when the balloon really does go up and the experimental matter hits the fan, you are going to have to literally flee. You may see, remember these newsreel photos and things you see on CNN of long columns of refugees fleeing, fighting somewhere? That is going to happen in this country. And there are going to be long columns of white refugees fleeing down the interstates, trying to desperately to get to the Pacific Northwest when that time comes. But these novels, a lot of people say, well, Harold, you're inciting to violence, you're inciting to armed overthrow of the government and all this sort of stuff. That's not entirely true, although that, of course, is an integral part of the plot. In these novels of mine, I'm not trying to tell young white people what they should do. I am trying to show them what they should be and who they should be, if you understand the difference. Because the essential problem that we have to solve is one of white character.
Let me address that issue, because what I think is I think white people are still living with the reality that existed 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they've woke up to what the current reality actually is. I think that they watch CNN and they see the pretty girls on Fox News and they tell them everything's okay and they believe it. And they're going to keep believing it until they walk out their front door someday and something hits them in the face. Then when that happens, they'll say, oh my God, this isn't the neighborhood I grew up in. When did this all happen? And they're going to act all surprised and they're going to act stunned. And then panic is going to set in. They're going to realize, oh my God, now what do I do? How do I handle this? And I want them to remember this.
Tell them what to do. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's why they need to be familiar with northwestfront.org, and they need to be familiar with the Northwest Front. Even if they don't do it right away, every white person in this country needs to have at least some little idea in the back of their mind, something they heard somewhere, something they saw on the net. Well, isn't there this big white country supposed to be created in the Northwest as a refuge for all white people, that, and so when we get in trouble here, we'll have some place to go? Didn't I see that on the internet someplace? This is why we need people to, if nothing else, if they won't do anything else at all, to spread the idea, spread the link to the website, get that idea into the mainstream, so to speak, among white people that, yes, someone is doing something. Someone is making a plan and implementing it. Yes, when the time comes when you finally have to admit that you just can't take it anymore and you just can't stay anymore where you are because you're going to get killed if you do, there is a place for you to go. That's essentially what we're trying to do up here in the Northwest right now. We're trying to make a place for white people to go when it finally becomes absolutely intolerable where they are.
Well, Harold, one of the things you said on a previous appearance on my show was that you said, if it's summertime and you can open the windows to your house, and if you hear the Ooga Booga music or you hear the La Cucaracha music in the background, you're too close. You need to move.
Exactly.
You need to move now because your neighborhood is already gone and you're just too sluggish, not astute enough to realize it because they're out there. You may be sitting quietly in your home, but they're out there and they're prowling the streets and they're looking for you.
Another way to phrase it might be, if you can hear their music outside, eventually they're going to be inside.
That's sad but true, and they are, and there's going to be more break-ins, there's going to be more home invasions, there's going to be more carjackings, there's going to be more theft. I mean, why do you think in ghetto areas that there aren't any grocery stores? Well, it's not because of lack of EBT cards and the cash flow there, it's because of the theft. It's because of the violence. It's because of all the things that go with this. And I'm sorry, folks, but you know, we can't fix these people. They have to fix themselves.
Yeah.
We've had this war on poverty and civil rights movement going on since 1959. It was the first time integration was forced in the U.S. at the point of a bayonet. And it doesn't seem to have made a hill of beans worth of difference in spite of spending $23 trillion on these boondoggle programs. Now, imagine how much better off this country would be if that $23 billion was back in the taxpayers' pockets and not in you know, the permanent underclass's pocket.
Well, you talk about like grocery stores and whatnot in the ghetto areas. I think there is probably nothing that speaks more eloquently to the level of squalor which the United States has reached that when you go into a grocery store, a liquor store, a convenience store, bowling alley, whatever, in some of these Negroid areas, the cashier and all the staff are at their cash registers and whatnot behind big, thick plates of bulletproof glass, and you can only do your transaction through a little sort of tray that slides back and forth. when you have a situation where merchants, people trying to earn an honest living, have to install bulletproof glass and in some cases arm their staff in order to protect themselves from their customers, from death and rape and robbery, then I can't think of anything that just says it all better than that. Something is deeply wrong, deeply sick in this country where a situation like that occurs. It's going to happen. I never cease to be amazed at the ability of this country to right itself and recover and stabilize after crisis, you know, mess after mess, and war after war. But you notice that every time it settles or stabilizes on a lower level, it's not like the Titanic that just hits an iceberg and all of a sudden it's going glug, 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 glug straight down. It's like a series of long, slow leaks in the American ship of state and society, and the ship is slowly, slowly, slowly sinking, and every now and then it'll stop and kind of wallow in the waves for a while, but then it'll start to slowly sink again. You know, I've been waiting for 42 years for it to go under, and I don't know if I'm going to live to see it yet, but the thing is that it is most definitely still going down. There is no question, because I'm sure you remember how things when we were 20, 21 years old.
And we've been suffering from the Helgian dialect for a long time, and that is that they have a problem, they create a solution, or they create a reaction, and they offer a solution. The solution moves us steadily. It's one of the basic premises of social engineering. And it's time to throw this off. It's time for people to stand up. And I've been calling for a dialogue in this country. You know, black, white, Hispanic, Asian, everybody needs to talk about what is the future of this country? What do we want it to look like? What do we want it to be? Everybody has a voice. Everybody needs to participate in this. We need to throw off the shackles of cultural Marxism. Get rid of this political correct nonsense and have some open dialogues. And maybe it is time for a divorce between the races. And
I think actually some of the more sane elements among the non-whites would agree with that, but you're never going to be allowed to have that dialogue because the Jews could not control it. The Jews will not allow any type of unilateral or lateral communication between the various factions, minority groups, whatnot. The Jews will not allow white people to go to blacks or brown people and speak honestly about the future of this country. Because if the blacks and the browns and the whites ever did, and the yellows ever did get together and decide about the future of this country, that future might not include the Jews, and they know it. So they will not allow such a... But why do you think that they jump on and cyber lynch any celebrity or anybody with any kind of fame who steps out of line verbally, uses an F word or an N word or whatever, or expresses some opinion about homos like Phil Robertson and whatnot? Why do you think that they impose what they call economic discipline on anybody who steps out of line ideologically? Because they know that they do not dare to allow honest, open dialogue about race, about the economy, about Marxism, about anything. If the Jews can't control it, we can't have it. And that's the bottom line.
We must be driving them crazy.
Oh, we are. Yeah, I've always found it amazing that they seem to be a lot more afraid of us and have a lot more appreciation for our potential than we do.
Well, that's a good thing. Well, it's their paranoia. And the thing of it is they know they commit crimes against people. They know that they've been guilty of genocide. They've been guilty of slaughter. They've been guilty of embezzling. The assets strip this entire country. You know, the jobs are all overseas. The people aren't making the money they used to. But they got richer. And they got richer and they got richer.
Seems to me I haven't gone medieval on your asses for quite a while. This is Fairport Convention.
Gaudete, Christus is natus, ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, Christus is natus, ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete. Tempus adens gratiae, o God optimamus, Carmine latitiae, devotine damas. Gaudete, Christus is natus, ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, Christus is natus, ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete. Deus homo factus est, natura mirante, mundus renovatus est, a Christo regnante. Gaudete, Christus is natus, ex Maria Virgine, Gaudete, Christus is natus, ex Maria.
Gaudete.
Ergo nostro continuo, saladiam in nostro, benedicat domino, salus regi nostro.
Gaudete, Gaudete, Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine. Gaudete, 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 Christus est natus, ex Maria Virgine. Gaudete.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. I'm delivering another Real Politics installment today. I struggled with exactly which of the remaining planned talks I would give because I've been asked questions which pertain to two of them. I almost persuaded myself to talk about things the party should and shouldn't do in public, and to answer a question someone sent me on Facebook. Another topic came up on the party message board, which was exactly in line with the talk I planned to give on the real politics of morality. Compared to the material on public activity, that on morality provides me the opportunity to reiterate some of the basics of real politics, so that's where I'm going. A Facebook guy, I promise I'm getting to your question, and I'm sorry for the delay. Now, the specific inquiry I'm responding to today came from a message board question which might or might not be an attempt to stir the pot. For the record, anytime someone approaches the party about religious issues, sexual deviancy, or whether or not they can use drugs, we almost always write them off. These subjects invite space madness, since anyone deeply concerned about ensuring the party is willing to tolerate their bad behavior is nothing but trouble. Granted, the person I'm responding to didn't indicate they themselves are interested in antisocial activity, but the extreme interest in such subjects is always a warning of something of which we need to steer clear. Beginning with the easiest of their concerns, I'll briefly sum up the religion thing again. The given concern was that the movement seems to cater to those of a fundamentalist, traditional religious bent. This was an issue because the questioner isn't at all interested in dealing with anyone religious. Firstly, it's not at all true that the movement is primarily concerned with any particular religion, as evidenced by the number of religions on offer, many of them downright anti-Christian. There's no trouble in having one religious preference over another, and with preference for one thing comes the opposite sentiment for another. Therefore, it's a matter of fact, the movement is going to contain those who have an issue with one religion specifically or the whole subject in general. That's all well and good, but doing anything with that dislike isn't welcome around the Northwest Front. The party doesn't have a religion plank and isn't going to. We deal with those of every faith and no faith. If you can't do the same, you're not going to fit in, because carrying around a religious grievance doesn't have anything to do with creating the Northwest American Republic or securing an existence for our people and a future for white children. Okay, this isn't exactly a morality issue, but I am answering a question which worked its way around to where I needed to go, and this was part of the question. The next item brought up was marijuana. Since I'm on the subject, it's generally best to know what the party's policy or projected idea is before calling us out on it. It has been suggested by more than one person, including Harold Covington, that pot not be illegal in the NAR since it might be useful as a state revenue monopoly. As it happens, there was a recent news item covering low revenues from legal pot sales in certain states. Apparently, it's not much of a cash cow. I certainly wasn't expecting that to be the case, either. I figured potheads would contribute a significant amount to their state's coffers. But oh well. The guy asking these questions was quite sure the party wants pot to be illegal. I know that the war on drugs is a stupid waste, but that doesn't mean any society should be equally as stupid to legalize drugs and greenlight their use, either. I personally hate potheads, but I've got bigger things to worry about than dumbasses getting high. If this sort of thing is more important to you than the 14 words, so be it. But we all need to understand something. Our sort of politics entails a certain amount of risk, and because of this, we need upright and decent people. Repeatedly altering your consciousness or habitual intoxication, even with legal medications, prohibits involvement with the party. We can't trust you if we have to worry about what you're doing or saying when you're not in your right mind. Period. And now, we're coming up to the main event. Morality proper. Here's where this gets fun. Oddly enough, the way white nationalism deals with matters of sexual perversion actually involves the basics as I've presented them. The party was given the argument that because there have always been faggots and dykes, we just have to accept them. After all, they're just like us, except they have different attractions. Now, if we consider this line of thought, we're presented with a particular principle which bears examination. That is, other people are what they are, and it's wrong to discriminate against people for being what they are, especially if they are inherently that way. But hold up. That's the same argument made against racism in general. Wait a second. I think I see the light. I'm free. I'm finally free of my racism. After all, we white nationalists just have to accept that there have always been other races, and there always will be. After all, they're just like us, except they have different amounts of melanin in their skin. Just like the Northwest American Republic allegedly shouldn't make being perverted illegal, it shouldn't make being non-white illegal either. White country's for everyone. That's it. I'm canceling the Northwest Front. The party is done. This podcast is over, and I'm queuing up the outro. Our time is up today, and you won't hear from us again. Remember, everyone, tolerance and diversity. Psych. Yeah, you didn't think that was actually happening, did you? It should be pretty obvious where I'm going with this, but I'm going to spell it out very clearly anyway because it's actually critical to understanding the basis for racial discrimination. As racists, we're absolutely drawing differences between groups of people based on what they innately are, even if they didn't choose to be that way. After all, when pests invade your home, you don't tolerate them on the basis that there have always been pests and there always will be. The reality that they can't be anything other than pests has no bearing on the necessity of discriminating against them and removing them from the space you occupy. And yes, discrimination is the right word for this. Look it up. Discrimination is merely the use of wise judgment. And so it is with perverts. It is entirely true that the draft constitution of the Northwest American Republic explicitly makes homosexual acts illegal. It's a lot like the war on drugs, actually. There's no point in conducting a perpetual hunt for drugs or deviants, but when they're found, severe punishment is most certainly due those involved. It's a lesser-known historical fact that colonial American society put a few people to death every year for provable commission of homosexual acts. When this issue was put to the party, the person doing so followed up that they want dyke and faggot culture suppressed, but this shows a basic disconnect with reality. Sodomites and the things they do, both public and private, are intrinsically connected, and you don't have one without the other. Their effect on society is exactly the reason they can't be allowed to indulge their desires. Now, the conversation so far has assumed that perversion is something set, rather than chosen. I won't argue the matter one way or the other since I don't fully know. I can confirm that twin studies indicate genetics cannot be a significant factor in the development of deviancy. But that's about it. Whether or not these filthy proclivities are voluntary isn't germane to the argument. It's well within the rights of a racially healthy society to prohibit sexual congress with non-whites, as the NAR must. But this means we've already crossed the line into what people may do in their private lives. Sure, non-whites won't be allowed to even exist in the NAR. But it's still the case that expectations of whites living in the Republic will be imposed by the government. Sexual correctness must certainly be one of them. With all that said, it looks like today is the day I become an old fart. I've been resisting making this particular point for a long time, since it means I'm no longer a young person per se. Regardless, I'm going to have to burn that bridge, since the occasion calls for it. The subjects I've addressed today were put to us by someone claiming they've either recently finished high school or are about to do so. This means they're likely of a certain age, and therefore, they've been raised in the recent past. which is easily the most disturbed and evil period in America's history. He says he's interested in preserving the white race, which is interesting given his other opinions. I'm not quite sure what to make of his claimed white nationalism. It could be that he's been made to see the light about race, but hasn't worked over the rest of the things he's been exposed to yet. If so, that's all right, since overhauling every single opinion one has can take time and effort. I know we have more than a few high school-aged boys and girls listening. Before I sign off for real this time, I'm going to try to share a little perspective that they won't have been exposed to. I was raised by a normal father and mother, in a healthy environment where I was taught mostly right. Granted, my parents were Zionist neocons, and I wasn't taught racial truth as a child, but I got over it. Anyhow, when I was still in high school, my mother told me a story which I'll share with you all now. She was born in the early 60s, which put her in high school in the mid to late 70s. Even then, society was very different. Sure, the rot was out in the open and had been for a long time, but things weren't quite what we've become accustomed to today. That goes doubly for you guys and gals out there who are still in high school. The story my mother told me, to give me the same perspective I'm trying to pass along to you, went like this. One night, she was attending a youth group meeting at her church, and they were being given some sort of sex ed presentation. The speaker started by asking the class if any of them knew what sex was. One of the seniors raised his hand and proudly told the speaker that sex is, wait for it, the number between 5 and 7. You heard that right. A senior in high school in the late 70s didn't know what sex is. I'm sure that wasn't the case for a large portion of the high school population at the time. Nevertheless, it's impossible to even imagine this today. Okay, that doesn't explicitly deal with perversion, but I really need you kids out there, and like it or not, that's what you are, to understand the world you were raised in is not normal or acceptable to decent white people. Just because you're surrounded by non-whites, race-mixing, political correctness, and perverts doesn't mean those things are good or that you should just accept their presence. The people who sold you those things are your enemy. They hate you. If they didn't hate you, they would have taught you what is right and good instead of all of the evil they forced into your minds and souls. The things you kids think are normal are most certainly not, and the world, especially history, is not as you've been told. If you can grasp this, you're going in the right direction. There's a phenomenon called movement modernization, which seeks, among other things, to accept Jews and homos. The Northwest Front will resist this to the last, even if no one else will. If we're going to go through all the trouble of creating another society, we had better make sure there aren't any gray areas amid the black and white social norms. The Jew lives in those gray areas, and immorality is always how they gain a foothold. If the NAR doesn't suppress societal rot, it will turn into America 2.0. Kikes and all. This must not be allowed to happen. Hail victory, comrades.
And here's one for all the folks in Scotland who today are voting in an independence referendum to see whether their country will become an independent nation once again.
It would be a serious mistake indeed to harbour the impression that our Scottish ancestors spent their hatred and their energies on fighting only the English. In between times, they kept in shape by fighting amongst themselves. Thus it was that in the year 1411, Donald of the Isles, with 10,000 of his fighting men, descended on Dingwall and Inverness to lay claim to the lands of Ross.
And come ye frae the Hielands, man, come ye a' the way. So ye MacDonald and Oz men as they come in frae Sky away. A-drum-a-doo and a tree and a drum, drum-a-droo-drum-cray. And come ye near or near enough, did ye their numbers see? Come tell to me, John Hieland, man, what might their numbers be? Way a-drum-a-doo and a tree and a drum, drum-a-droo-drum-cray. Well, I come in by the Garry land, doon by Netherhaw.
I saw MacDonald and Oz men a marching to Harlow.
Way a drum a doo and a tree and a drum a drum a doo drum gray.
The Hieland men with their long swords fell in at us who's there, and they drove back where Lawland men 3 acres spread for mare.
Way a drum a doo and a tree and a drum a drum a doo drum gray.
Lord Ford estate his brother did say, oh brother, dinna you see, they've driven us back on Anka's sight and we'll be forced to flee.
Way a drum a doo and a tree and a drum a drum a doo drum gray.
Oh no, 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 my brother dear, this thing it munna be. You'll take your good sword in your hand and you'll gan in with me.
Away da-rum-a-doo and a tree and a drum da-rum-a-doo drum tray.
The first blow that Lord Ford has struck, the sword ran in an hell. The second blow Lord Ford has struck, the great MacDonald fell.
Away da-rum-a-doo and a tree and a drum da-rum-a-doo drum tray.
Stick a cry free among the Hieland men when they see their leader fall. They carted him and buried him along by Fair Harlaw.
Away da-rum-a-doo and a tree and a drum, 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 drum.
Gin any in should spear a G for them that's gone awa'. Just tell them plain and uncomplain they're sleeping at Harlaw.
Way a drum a doo and a tree and a drum, drum a doo drum dray.
Way a drum a doo and a tree and a drum, drum a doo drum dray.
Okay, out of time again. Boy, time flies when you're having fun. Quick wind up. Yes, for those of you who are wondering, we are moving forward. In the past few weeks, we've recovered nicely from the traditional summer slump. Hits are up on the website, and I finally figured out a way to assess the computer downloads and replays of Radio Free Northwest from the stat counter we use. So now I have some idea of our actual audience, which was pretty much what I thought it was, allowing for intermittent listeners, in other words, people who just drop in every few weeks and listen to an episode or two. That's kind of hard to calculate. I am sending out more intro packs, and we are, in fact, welcoming more migrants to the homeland, including 5 here in the Pugetopolis in the past month or so, 2 more in Idaho and 1 in Oregon recently, whom I haven't met. Now, we've got a first-rate meter and greeter in Montana, but we really could use somebody in both Idaho and Oregon to step forward and take on the burden of being an actual state leader. We now have 3 primary settlement areas, and they're starting to draw some interest and a few for real migrating bodies. But I'll talk about all that in future issues of the newly revived party organizational letter, which I have now recommitted to sending out once a month. It kind of fell into abeyance there for a while for reasons I won't get into. Yes, it's way too slow to have any real effect on events if the balloon does go up anytime soon. But the mountain really is beginning to move. And I'm out of time, so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98194, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.